The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Crime Prevention 101. We're so happy you joined us this week. Over the next hour, you'll learn the tips, tricks, and vital information that will help you keep yourself confident and safe. Now, here's your host, Susan Bartlestone.
Have you ever heard of verdict in a high-profile case that left you absolutely dumbfounded, scratching your head and wonder, you know, how did they get this bunch of idiots on a jury? I mean, I've heard verdicts that I just was totally flabbergasted. Rapists set free, murderers sentenced to only a few years in prison, and then of course they go out and kill again. And then what about those ridiculous verdicts? I mean, I remember a case where a would-be burglar fell through the roof of a building that he was preparing to break into and rob. And the jury found the building owner liable for not keeping the roof repaired and gave that thief money. And, of course, the poster case for ridiculous, excessive lawsuits. The woman who spilled a hot cup of McDonald's coffee on herself because she put it between her legs while she was driving. That jury awarded her almost $2.9 million, and it was eventually reduced to $640,000. Still, not too shabby. Well, you know what? I'm done scratching my head. I got my first real glimpse of how the jury process works 2 weeks ago when I was questioned but not picked for what would have been a very spicy kind of murder case. And I actually have a much better understanding of how the system works and how these seemingly insane decisions can actually happen. And in fact, now I'm trying to figure out how some juries actually get it right, you know, give a decision that I approve of. So to help me and you, I think, figure this all out, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Kathy Kellerman, who is an expert on jury profiling. And then you're going to hear from some people who've had very interesting experiences on jury duty, including a woman who served for 6 months on the second Tyco trial, which before Bernie Madoff, if you remember, was the largest financial fraud trial in this country. And I've also got a woman who blew the whistle on a tainted jury with unexpected results. And I'll be talking a little bit more about my jury duty experience, too. I'm Susan Bartlestone. Welcome to Crime Prevention 101, coming to you from the ever-exciting New York City. And it's perfect weather for a hot, sticky topic. And what heats up the blood more than a good, true crime report? Now, tonight, we're featuring an icon in the horror genre, Hart D. Fisher, who knows a lot about horrible crimes and has his own jury horror stories as well. And this is his second appearance on Crime Prevention 101, and I'm really delighted to have him back because he's such an interesting person to talk to. He's done just about everything. He was dubbed the most dangerous man in comics because of his serial killer comic books. He's known for taking his work to the extreme. He's been on Murder by the Numbers, Larry King Live, and of course he blogs on one of my favorite true crime sites, In Cold Blog. Welcome, Hart.
Good. Well, I don't know if it's morning or evening when this is going to be on, but you've got me up way too early for this.
This show is one of my few pre-recorded shows that you're in. And I did have to get Hart up very early because he's out in California.
And you know, I hate to mention it, but you know, you brought up the McDonald case in the opening, and I will say this, that McDonald's was cited many times for having coffee far too hot, and that old woman had to have skin grafts on her vagina.
That's true.
She got that money. So yeah, there's a lot of people who talk about that, but McDonald's was previously cited for having too hot coffee many times, and that poor woman did have to get skin grafts on her vagina as a grandmother.
There was, yes, she did have injuries, but
so
you're not.
She did have injuries.
But you're not supposed to put a cup of coffee between your legs while you're driving. I mean, she had. I'm not saying. I think a fair
coffee of death
thing would have been pay for her medical expenses, pay for any rehabilitation, maybe.
That's all I see is, you know, take
you
care
don't
of medical
put,
bills.
That's what the coffee cup holder is there for. That's
mm-hmm.
where you put the coffee.
And
you sip it first, and you when you feel it's too hot, you blow on it.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
All right, but anyway. All right, anyway, you're working on a new project. Now, you do everything. You do TV, you do movies, you do music videos, but you're working on a new book, and it's about a very interesting topic for me, a reformed Chicago gangster. Talk a little bit about the book and this fellow.
Well, you know, the gentleman is a person who grew up on the south side of Chicago, has been in and out of institutions. I mean, we're talking about a kid who was abused as a child by his mother. He was jumped into the gang at 11. He was jacking people with a gun at the age of 12. He jacked a yuppie for his Porsche
at the age 12?
Of 12.
Could
yeah, at 12 years
could
old.
Could he even drive it at 12?
He managed to drive away that Porsche at 12. he's had a really brutal, brutal life. He has been in and out of prisons and facilities and Cook County Jail, and I'm working on a book with him about his life, and he's trying to straighten out his life now, and he's got a beautiful, beautiful children and a beautiful wife, and it's really tough for some of these guys to relearn how to live. You know, a lot of these criminals are damaged people. You know, many of them have had traumatic childhoods and mm-hmm. grew up in areas that were pretty tough. I mean, I know where I grew up in Chicago and Blue Island was kind of rough what I dealt with. So we really get along. We see eye to eye. And, you know, it's kind of interesting for my television show, American Horrors. A lot of what we do is we get really interested in real life horror and what scares scary people. You know, I do mixed martial arts and I train with Gene LaBelle and Gokor. And it's interesting to talk to these martial arts guys about what scares them. And it's interesting to talk to this gentleman about what scares him, because, you know, he's afraid of things.
So what scares him? Now, he was a gangbanger. He spent how many years in prison? He's a tough guy.
He was first locked up when he was 13. He was locked up in Cook County Jail from 15 to 17, 18 years old. He did his first real time in the slam with a year in Wisconsin. And then after that, he was in and out of jail, you know, here and there, off and on for the rest of his life.
So what scares him?
He hasn't been able to finish Hostel 2. That's a film that really is too much for him. He can't take the rape or torture. If he sees somebody being raped on screen or a child being molested, he gets physically sick. It makes him so angry. He wants to crawl on the screen and kill the perpetrators. Like when he was a kid, don't answer the phone scared the hell out of him. When he was a teenager and he started doing violent crimes, you know, The Exorcist scared the hell out of him. Or Last House on the Left. As an adult, he says that Hostel and Natural Born Killers just made his stomach hurt and it gave him a headache. He said when he came out of Natural Born Killers, he just had a migraine.
Well, those I can't even watch those either. I absolutely cannot. But you would think that a person who kills or who, you know, steals or who has, you know, seen the worst in prison.
Yeah, a guy who, you know, probably
feel a lot less squeamish. Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, but I'm with him on that. I can't watch those movies either. I can't watch and even forget horror movies, even if I see TV shows where there's any kind of brutal crime. And they're getting so realistic now.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of trouble watching those. And I'll fast forward through it or I'll turn it off. Because I deal with it all the time. I deal with the victims all the time. So
that's
those things hit too
home. His fear is victimization of his family. You know, that's a big fear for him. And in working on this book, you know, we are having to make the decisions of, well, what are we going to tell the world? How much of this are we going to identify? what's going to make, you know, how much of this can we open up and talk about without endangering his family?
Mm.
You know, that's a real issue for us as we go through this book, and I've made a point to him to let him know that, hey, you know, this book's about you, and it's about your journey. It's not about the gang. It's not about, you know, oh, I'm a guy who beat up people. No, this is really about, you know, you grew up in hell, and this is about you trying to get out of it. This is about your journey out of darkness.
And what is he doing? How did he make this decision? Have you gotten to that point in the interviewing with him? How did he make the decision that he doesn't want to go back to jail anymore and he doesn't want to break the law anymore? And what's he doing to turn himself around?
He's been he's part of, he actually is a singer and plays in the heavy metal scene, and he puts a lot of his anger into his music. He's active, you know, as a promoter for music. He puts a lot of his aggression into that. He actually does have, he has real problems with anger control, with assaults and batteries, you know. He grew up in an area where you had to react immediately and viciously to any, quote, affront to his space or his physicality. And it used to be violent, you know, this was a very violent animal.
And that's how you survive in jail, too, isn't it?
And he has been steadily trying to work out old wants and warrants and just work with the system. And he has family and law enforcement in Chicago, so he's had people to help him work his way through the system. And he's got a daughter, and he's got a wife who's got a good job, and, you know, they're helping him. They're helping him rehab and learn a new way to do things, and that's not so easy when you're in your 40s.
No, it's not. Tell him meditation. Very good thing.
Yeah, I work a lot with him, telling him, like, you know, hey, you can't let the barking dogs and their fences, you know, get on you. There's lots of little dogs in the world. There's going to be a lot of people that bark at you, and you got to learn to push your own buttons and not let them push your buttons.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Well, Hart, give out your website so people who love those horror things can find you there, and I'd like them to if they want to.
Cool. Well, you know, I definitely want people to come and find me on www.americanhorrors.com. I'd love to have people stop by. I'm on Twitter, and I'm also on MySpace. And definitely check out my writing on InCol blog. I've got some recent posts up for this month. It's pretty intense reading, because when I write true crime, I really try to immerse myself in what I'm doing and immerse my audience in the reality of the moment. And that's what I'm trying to do with the writing on InCol blog, and where I'm writing about. You talked about runaway juries and issues with juries. I dealt with that quite a bit in the second murder trial where I had to testify in. We had a real problem in which there was an issue in the 90s where there was a wave of not guilty by black or not guilty by Latino, in which my theories were.
Hart, I'm gonna ask you to save that.
Sure.
Because
sure.
We'll have you back and talk about it. Hart's had some great jury. Well, she's had some amazing jury.
I wouldn't call it great or amazing.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it. I realize that. Go back to that. If you want to hear about some of the things he's been involved in, on May 20th, we had Hart first. And Hart, you'll come back again. Let's talk again.
Yeah, definitely. Only next time, a little later in the day.
Definitely. All right. Thanks so much for being with me. This is Crime Prevention 101, the radio show with an optimistic perspective on a sober subject. Coming up, why wouldn't an attorney want me to serve on their jury? Maybe I'll find out when we come back, and we'll be speaking with jury profiler Dr. Kathy Kellerman. So stay tuned.
News. Opinion.
Hear me.
Your voice counts. Call toll-free 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787. VoiceAmerica.com.
Hi, this is Susan Bartlestone, host of Crime Prevention 101, and I want to tell you about My Mobile Witness, a revolutionary service that transforms your camera phone into a personal safety device. My Mobile Witness believes safety is improved when you remove anonymity from dangerous scenarios. If you're in a stalking situation, for example, if you have an order of protection against someone, or if your profession places you in situations that are potentially dangerous, I want you to check out My Mobile Witness. And you parents of college students, ask the school to check out the My Mobile Witness University program with custom-tailored options aimed at keeping both students and faculty safe. Every campus could benefit from the My Mobile Witness University service. For more information, go to mymobilewitness.com.
After more than 17 years' experience teaching safety skills to thousands of women and men, crime prevention and personal safety expert Susan Bartlestone concluded that by thinking and responding quickly, ideally within 20 seconds, potentially violent criminal encounters can be prevented. Using techniques from many different disciplines and illustrated by 60 real-life examples and success stories, Susan shows how it's done in her new book, Think Fast and Prevent a Violent Crime, how to respond to danger in 20 seconds or less. Check out www.crimeprevention101.com for more information. Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com. You're listening to Crime Prevention 101 with Susan Bartlestone. Susan would like to remind you that no absolutes exist in a crime scenario, and no advice can possibly address every variable. Each situation should be evaluated individually and responded to in a way you instinctively judge best. It's Susan's aim on this show to provide you with the information and options that will help you make that instinctive assessment quickly and safely. And if you're already a survivor of the kind of crime we're talking about on the show today, or any other crime for that matter, please remember that there are no right or wrong responses in a criminal encounter, and nothing that happened to you was your fault. Even if you think you used bad judgment in a situation and left yourself vulnerable, that's never an excuse for a crime or for violence. So please, call yourself a survivor, not a victim, and understand that with time, distance, and the proper professional help, you can put what happened into perspective and get on with your life. If you'd like to share your stories, tips, or suggestions for topics you'd like us to cover, send your comments to solutions@fightsafe.com, and Susan may address some of them on future shows. That email address again, solutions@fightsafe.com. Now, back to Crime Prevention 101.
Susan Bartlestone here, and there's plenty of show left to tune in for. So please start tweeting about us, and don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter and Facebook. I have over 4,000 friends now. Come join the party with me. Now, let's meet Dr. Kathy Kellerman. She's a trial consultant, which also includes jury profiling, and I want to see if we can find out why they didn't want me on that jury. Now, Dr. Kellerman is a nationally recognized authority on persuasion and communication. Her company is called ComCon, and it's a litigation consulting service. And she's been assisting attorneys for more than 13 years all over the country, analyzing cases, interviewing and selecting juries, conducting post-trial interviews, and all that stuff that attorneys like. She also regularly serves as a media commentator on trials and jury issues, and for several years, co-hosted a highly regarded radio show called Santa Barbara Law. So I'm delighted to have her here. She says call her Kathy. She's very informal. And Kathy, maybe you can help me out here eventually about why they didn't pick me for the jury. let me tell you real quick. Some very brief things, and then let's talk a little bit more about the jury process and what jurors are looking for. Now, this was such an interesting experience for me because most of the time when I'd been called for jury duty, all I did was sit in a room and did nothing, and then they dismissed me a day.
That's a common experience, actually.
That's common. So this time they picked about 30 of us right off the bat, shunted us off to the side in a little bit of a jury room where we did sit for a little while. Then they put us into a courtroom. And then out of a one of those bingo cages that they pull out the numbers from, they started calling names. And they took 15 people, put them into the actual jury box. And I'm assuming that that was probably the courtroom that we would have been in.
Mm-hmm. I believe so.
Right. The judge was there. The assistant district attorney, known as an ADA, was there. The defense attorney, who I found out later was a legal aid attorney, was there, and the defendant was there. And all we were told was that this defendant was accused of 4 counts of murder, second degree. She was accused of assault, and she was accused of arson. And this woman was, it was hard to say how old she was because she was heavily scarred on her face and her upper body. And I realized that that must have come from the fire. And she looked like she was wearing a wig. And she looked very frail. And she looked very, you kind of would feel sympathy for her.
Sure.
They told us absolutely nothing about the crime except that she was accused of these 4 murders. And then they started asking us different questions. And this is kind of common procedure, correct?
Yes, voir dire is common, and in a criminal case like this that's serious, where I'm sure the person is facing potentially life in prison, the voir dire will be a little bit longer than normal.
Mm-hmm. They said it was not a death penalty case, which I thought was good. And they asked us questions like, over and over again, can you be fair and impartial? Can you be fair and impartial? Can you be fair and impartial? Can you not feel sympathy for the defendant or someone who's, you can see visible injuries on her? They asked a lot of questions to me, Kathy, and I thought as soon as they found out that I was a crime prevention specialist and a talk show radio host, that they would have asked me no questions. But I figured I was clearly somebody that they didn't want on the jury. But both the ADA and the defense attorney asked me lots of questions. Would I be a super juror? Would I feel it incumbent to instruct the other people on the jury? Was I going to talk about the trial on my radio show, which I told them you can be guaranteed I'm going to speak about it after a trial, after it's over, things like that. What were they looking for? What do attorneys want on a murder case like this, or in general, maybe?
Well, I guess my first question to you would be, which side was asking you which questions, because each side is looking for something different. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, both of them asked very similar questions, which also surprised me.
That's a bit surprising also. Here is, I can't say what their goals were. I can only tell you what I talk with attorneys whom I'm working for.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you can't select the jurors that you want. You can only deselect jurors.
Right.
So many attorneys look for jurors they want, and then the other side excuses them or strikes them. And it's incumbent upon most attorneys to almost, I think, if they want to be more effective, to switch their tactics and to look for jurors that may not be receptive to what they have to say. So,
really?
Yes, because you can't select who you want. You can only excuse a certain number of jurors. You can only say, we don't want this juror. And so I believe it's more effective to interview jurors. And if you know you like a juror, to do one of two things. Either say nothing to that juror, not speak to them. In other words, why would they talk to you? Or alternatively, if you know that you like a juror, but you know the other side will excuse that juror, then use that juror to educate the rest of the jury about some issue of importance to you. So you might talk to, but you only do that if you have time and the judge isn't urging you to deal with other types of problems.
Well, let's see now. I know that they did ask us certain questions and they eliminated those people, even though they didn't say they were going to. They asked, does anyone have a police officer in their family? Because there are going to be police officers testifying, and and we're supposed to keep their testimony. They're not to be given any more credibility than anyone else. There's going to be a fire marshal. Did anyone have firemen in their family? Because we can't give more weight. They're just regular people. We have to consider them that way. They're going to be other experts. Experts cannot be given any more weight. Is that typical? I mean, how do we not give weight to an expert?
Well, no, there are those types of questions are typical. It's not that you're not to give weight to experts, but that you could reject expert testimony if you didn't agree with it. And that's usually the form of the expert question. But in terms of policemen and firemen, I mean, the judge's interest is, can you be fair and impartial? And he will ask that question.
Yes.
The defense attorney's interest, the defense attorney is the one who's most likely to ask if you have connections to law enforcement or know people who are law enforcement officers, because the defense attorney will be concerned that people who have a lot of connections to law enforcement officers may sympathize with the prosecution. And so it's less likely to be a question the prosecutor would ask. And so it's a matter of what it is that you believe will make it harder for you to forward your case. That's from the defense and the prosecution side. And from the judge's side, the judge will always step in and say, does this matter? Will you weight the testimony differently? Will you be able to be fair and impartial? And so that's ultimately the interest of the three parties is different. So instead of saying they, that's why I kept saying which side asks certain questions, because the experience you have and the person you're excused by will depend upon whose interest it is.
I kind of remember both sides asking different people those kind of questions. There were a number of us on that jury who did have relatives in the police department, in the courts, and in the fire department. There was also a woman who was an emergency room nurse, and she was not selected as well. There were a number of students, and this I thought was so interesting too. There were a number of students there between the age of like 19 and 21. And I was wondering myself, you know, if I was 20, could I find someone guilty of murder knowing that that person might be in jail for the rest of their life? And, you know, would I be able to do that and not worry about second guessing myself for the rest of my life? Did I make the right decision, or even do I have enough life experience to make that kind of a judgment? And those students were not selected either, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah,
maybe that occurred to the
well, you know, it's not so much what they find is that demographics only occasionally matter. Generally, demographics aren't the issue. The more important issue are people's attitudes. And attitudes are related to your life experiences. And so to some degree, age could creep in that way. But by and large, some people are, for example, people who have law enforcement members in their family are more likely to favor law enforcement. And that's based on their experiences, and maybe they were a crime victim, maybe they have law enforcement members in their family, but there are people who are more oriented towards the prosecution side. Similarly, there are people who are more oriented towards the defense side, people who have been victims who have been or perceive themselves to have been victims of police misconduct. Will mm-hmm. sympathize more often with the defense. As it comes to students, the key marker in students as an attitude that needs to be examined many times, depending on which side you're on. If you're on the prosecution side, you would want to examine, are they less likely to enjoy authority? Because many people in the age group between 19 and 21 are still in the rebellion towards authority stage, and they mm-hmm. distrust authority. And not all. And so students in that age group vary. And so what you would be interested in investigating is, what is their attitude towards authority? And what you find is that age group, those who are college students at certain colleges, are much more likely to be hesitant about authority than are students at other types of colleges or perhaps students who have not gone to college. And so that's all, it's less the demographic than it is the attitude. And so I could see one or the other side excusing a juror because they thought, for example, that they would not be favorable towards authority figures. The prosecution would be interested in that. The defense, mm-hmm. on the other hand, might worry about students who seem to have overly strong attitudes towards authority. Maybe not students, but in the people in that age group who might be oriented towards wanting to become a police officer or wanting to, or having very dichotomous attitudes and versus sort of gray area attitudes. Because your question goes to what I would call the gray area, the nuanced area. And that's the attitude that matters more. Is this person a person who makes hard and fast decisions, who sees clear rights and wrongs, or is this a person who sees nuances?
Because no, I don't. I don't think they could have told that from the brief kind of questions that they had. But you know what, Kathy? Stick around with me, all right? We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to hear some fascinating stories. For instance, what happens when the prosecuting attorney is so handsome you can't keep your mind on the case? I love this story.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
After more than 17 years' experience teaching safety skills to thousands of women and men, crime prevention and personal safety expert Susan Bartlestone concluded that by thinking and responding quickly, ideally within 20 seconds, potentially violent criminal encounters can be prevented. Using techniques from many different disciplines and illustrated by 60 real-life examples and success stories, Susan shows how it's done in her new book, Think Fast and Prevent a Violent Crime, how to respond to danger in 20 seconds or less. Check out www.crimeprevention101.com for more information.
Hi, this is Susan Bartlestone, host of Crime Prevention 101, and I want to tell you about My Mobile Witness, a revolutionary service that transforms your camera phone into a personal safety device. My Mobile Witness believes safety is improved when you remove anonymity from dangerous scenarios. If you're in a stalking situation, for example, if you have an order of protection against someone, or if your profession places you in situations that are potentially dangerous, I want you to check out My Mobile Witness. And you parents of college students, ask the school to check out the My Mobile Witness University program with custom-tailored options aimed at keeping both students and faculty safe. Every campus could benefit from the My Mobile Witness University service. For more information, go to mymobilewitness.com.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You're listening to Crime Prevention 101 with Susan Bartlestone. We invite you to share your stories, tips, or suggestions for topics you'd like us to cover, and Susan will address some of these on future shows. Send your story or idea to solutions@fightsafe.com. That email address again is solutions@fightsafe.com. Now, back to Crime Prevention 101 with Susan Bartlestone.
This is Crime Prevention 101. I'm Susan Bartlestone. We're talking about juries and how they make their decisions with Dr. Kathy Kellerman, who's a trial consultant and an expert on juries and communication. And you can find out more information about her and also some really interesting articles on juries at her website, www.comcon.com. That's a mouthful. And now I just want to
just finish up what we were talking about before the break, and then I want you to hear from some people who are jury veterans, and boy, do they have some interesting stories. Now, just to wrap up and tell you just a couple of little facts about the case that I didn't get on. The defendant was a 48 years old at the time. She was a former stock trader. Her boyfriend, who she was accused of setting on fire, was 31 years old. So you had that kind of cougar thing going on. He was a carpet cleaner, so you had that interesting dynamic going on. And they had broken up after 3 years. They went out clubbing, though, because they were supposedly they were still friendly. Something must have happened. She came home that night, got into a fight, threw cleaning fluid on him, set him on fire, which is how she got injured. But the fire spread to the apartment building, and three people who lived upstairs died in the fire. Two others escaped by jumping out of windows and were seriously injured. So this was a heavy-duty trial. And I got to tell you, I mean, they told us nothing. I found this out when I came back, and I looked up the trial. I would not have wanted to have served on that trial. That would have been tough for me.
You know, it's not uncommon that jurors have that kind of a reaction, and there's two or three reactions. Sometimes the case is so serious, jurors are hesitant about serving. Sometimes jurors don't want to serve because it's difficult in their life, or sometimes people just don't want to be a juror. And what I have found, after jurors are sworn in, sometimes there's a panic look on their face. But after a trial is over, jurors, 99% walk away with incredible respect for the system and have a very different attitude about jury service afterwards than ahead of time. They take it seriously. And most of the time, most juries are pretty serious about what they do. There may be individuals that have problems, but the juries themselves do a pretty good job.
Well, I agree with you there, and then we're going to talk to a couple of people now who've served on some juries and had some interesting experiences. I want to read one quick story to you. This was sent to me by, her name is Ann Pryor, and she said that the most memorable jury duty experience I ever had, when I was called to jury duty in New York City in the early 1990s, and conducting the voir dire was a fantastically handsome man. She says she could not take her eyes off of him. She couldn't concentrate on anything that he was saying. She made strange, silly answers when he asked her questions. She was not selected for the jury, but came to find out that the person interviewing her was John F. Kennedy Jr. And if you might remember, he originally started his career as an ADA in New York City, Manhattan, and she had the unfortunate or the fortunate experience to be questioned by him, and she said, I couldn't have served on that trial. I just couldn't have paid any attention to anything.
You know, interestingly enough, you do watch if somebody is attracted to or dislikes a particular attorney. That isn't always the decisive factor, but if there's a strong reaction one way or the other, it's something that is worth noting and at least being attentive to. If somebody is very attracted to a particular attorney, hopefully the other side perceives that and excuses that juror.
If somebody
very much dislikes a particular attorney, hopefully
exactly.
That side notices it and excuses that juror. I'm not sure it's always noticed or attended to. It is worth being attentive to from the point of view of an attorney, I would think. From the point of view of a juror, I've never heard a juror speak up and say, I can't concentrate because of this, although that is a reason to be excused.
Well, she wasn't going to say that. She wanted to serve, but he obviously picked it up because she was kind of blathering and whatever. But anyway, now I want to introduce you now to Francine Travers. Trevins?
Right.
Francine served for 6 months on the second Tyco jury trial, the one that actually convicted Mr. Kozlowski and Mr. Schwartz. Francine, welcome to Crime Prevention 101.
Thank you.
Now, this was a six-month trial. I want you to tell me in 5 minutes what happened on that trial.
That's a little impossible, but
I know.
We were asked before we even were questioned at all. If we wished to serve on a jury, that would probably be 6 months, and we filled out questionnaires and then got called in. And normally there are two extras on a jury, alternates. We had four alternates, and we were in the same room that a normal 12-person jury was in, and it was crowded and cramped. And we knew we were in for 6 months, but we tried to pay attention. At first, we were very confused by the case because every single person who went on the stand called by the prosecution was in favor of these two guys and said how terrific they were. And ultimately, it dawned on us that every one of these people had been forgiven a major loan from the company, so that millions and millions of dollars had been forgiven in debt just at the time that Tyco was beginning to tank anyway. So that was our first inclination that something was not kosher here. The trial continued, and I think that the two defendants actually, well, one of them anyway, definitely hung themselves by the testimony they get because we couldn't believe anything they said.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that. You said the prosecutor was, the prosecution was actually too complimentary, and the defense sunk the case. Kathy, have you ever heard of something like this?
I'm sorry?
She said, Francine was telling me when we were talking before that the prosecution was too complimentary to the case, and that the defense sunk it.
That the defense did what?
Francine, you didn't believe anything that the defense was saying, right?
Well, the prosecution had given us a great deal of facts. Too many facts, possibly, because we were getting confused. But when they called Kozlowski to the stand and he tried to explain what he claimed had happened, none of us could believe what he said because we already had so many other facts that had been proven. And he lived in a gated community. He claimed that some woman drove up into this gated community to his house with some artwork and talked him into buying them. You don't believe that a CEO of a major corporation who's done some of the things he has done could be talked into anything. And second of all, how did she get into the gated community and why did she choose him? Things like that were unbelievable.
And they found him guilty, and it was a $600 million grand larceny, securities fraud, and corruption trial. Francine, thank you so much for sharing your story.
You know, I'm familiar with the trial in a general sense. As in terms of Francine's experience, it's very rare for a defendant to testify because usually the entire trial then hinges on that person's testimony. And if the jurors believe the person, then they're let go. So William Kennedy Smith, for example. On the other hand, if the jurors don't believe the person, then they're harshly punished. And I would say 99% of the time, the jurors don't believe the defendant. And so it's very risky to put a defendant on the stand.
Well, in the first trial, they didn't have Kozlowski testify, and I guess they thought that he was going to convince us of his sincerity, and that's why they had him trialed on this.
For instance, I thank you so much. We need to kind of chop this down a little bit because I've got another calling coming on. But it's a fascinating trial, and I thank you so much for calling in. All right, Kathy, now I want to talk to our second caller, and this is Martine LaRusso. And she had an interesting experience as a whistleblower. Martine, are you there with me?
Yes, I am. Hi, Susan. How are you?
Hi. Martine, give me about 5 minutes. It's a long story, but give me 5 minutes how you blew the whistle on this trial.
What happened was that I was called down for jury duty, and we were in a group. I think they call them jury pools, and we were out in the hallway. And a group of us were always staying together and talking, and suddenly one of the people who were with us, this guy, came over and he said, "You won't believe this, you know, I met this girl and she's on trial." And then he goes on explaining exactly what her case was about, wasn't her fault, and it was the other guys and everything. And we're listening to this. Next thing I know, we're being called into the courtroom and you have to sit in the back, and the judge is up front with the two lawyers and the defendants. And as we're sitting down, the guy says, "That's the girl. That's the girl I was talking to." And I thought, oh, shit, now what am I going to do? So we all sit there, and I look at each other. We don't say anything. next thing I know, the lawyers are doing their thing, and they call down the first 5 or 10 people to talk to, and he's one of them. So I'm waiting and watching to see what happens, thinking, thank God they didn't call me. And they question him, and do you know the defendants? And he goes, no. And before I know it, they accept him as a juror. So there he is. He's been accepted on the case. And I'm thinking, I don't think this can happen. Somebody has to do something. So I looked at everybody. I said, somebody has to do something. Nobody's getting up. And they start questioning somebody else. So I raise my hand, and I say, Your Honor, and the judge looks up at me. And I say, can I approach the bench? Because I know I watch television. I know you can say that.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at me, and he says, do you have to? And I said, yes, yes. He says, is it important? I said, yes. So he goes, come on down. Not like come on down with the Price is Right, come on down. More like when you're in high school and you hear the principal says, come on down. So now I'm walking down to this, and I go over to him, and I whisper to him, and I say to him, we know about this case. Suddenly he stops me, very, very cool, stops me. He says to me, why don't we all go into the chambers? So I go into the chambers, and the other lawyers come into the chambers. I sit on this chair, and I go hysterical crying, telling this guy that we all know, that the guy that they just put down as a juror, he already knows about the case. I don't think you're allowed to do this. Don't get me into any trouble. And he just looks at
Martine,
me.
Martine, let me jump in here because I don't want to have to cut you off before the end of the story. But the bottom line was you told him that the jury had been...
Yes, what happened was that he said to me, how many people know this? And I said to him, well, I know the whole group of us know it, that we were talking, and this guy has a very loud voice. I don't know how many people heard it. So he just turns to the lawyers, and he says to them, do you think that you could keep your client away from my jurors? Now I have to get rid of the entire jury pool. I have to let them go because they've been tainted.
Absolutely.
I have to take them. We have to wait all this time, and we have to get another 100 people. And then
he was not happy. He was not happy, correct?
He was not
happy at all.
He was.
And the other horrible thing about this story, Martine, is that someone who clearly should not have been serving on that jury, right, Kathy, was selected.
I think it's great that you spoke up, because the juror has a duty to speak up who did the talking when asked the question about knowing the defendant or having spoken with the defendant. And I can see the judge's anger, because I've seen this kind of issue before. And they do, 100 jurors called for jury duty can't serve because of misconduct on the part of the defendant.
Exactly, because I ran into this guy. He was in my neighborhood. I was so afraid they were going to give me away. And he told me that the entire, you know, that they were all sort of questioned and that they had to let them all go.
Yes, and it's sad, because that wastes everybody time. It's hard to get jurors. It's hard to have jurors show up, and then to lose 100 potential jurors because of misconduct on the part of the defendant. And it's clear misconduct.
I'll tell you something. When the judge said to the lawyer, do you think that you could please keep your clients away from my jurors? This has happened before.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know,
You know what? Let me just interrupt here, because you know we're coming down to the wire. You saved the day, Martine. Thank you so much for that. We would have had a tainted jury there for sure, and someone who shouldn't have been on there. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. Kathy, Dr. Kellerman, thank you so much for being with me today. And maybe, you know, I think this subject bears more witness. We need to talk about it more. Just want to give your website out one more time. It was www.kk.com, and I'm going to post a link to it on my Crime Prevention 101 website. Thanks so much, both of you.
Thank you.
Now, this is Crime Prevention 101. Stay right where you are. Got another quick jury duty story for you coming back up, and maybe a few more tricks up my sleeve. Stay tuned.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Hi, this is Susan Bartlestone, host of Crime Prevention 101, and I want to tell you about My Mobile Witness, a revolutionary service that transforms your camera phone into a personal safety device. My Mobile Witness believes safety is improved when you remove anonymity from dangerous scenarios. If you're in a stalking situation, for example, if you have an order of protection against someone, or if your profession places you in situations that are potentially dangerous, I want you to check out My Mobile Witness. And you parents of college students, ask the school to check out the My Mobile Witness University program with custom-tailored options aimed at keeping both students and faculty safe. Every campus could benefit from the My Mobile Witness University service. For more information, go to mymobilewitness.com.
After more than 17 years' experience teaching safety skills to thousands of women and men, crime prevention and personal safety expert Susan Bartlestone concluded that by thinking and responding quickly, ideally within 20 seconds, potentially violent criminal encounters can be prevented. Using techniques from many different disciplines and illustrated by 60 real-life examples and success stories, Susan shows how it's done in her new book, Think Fast and Prevent a Violent Crime, how to respond to danger in 20 seconds or less. Check out www.crimeprevention101.com for more information.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You're listening to Crime Prevention 101 with Susan Bartlestone. We invite you to share your stories, tips, or suggestions for topics you'd like us to cover, and Susan will address some of these on future shows. Send your story or idea to solutions@fightsafe.com. That email address again is solutions@fightsafe.com. Now, back to Crime Prevention 101 with Susan Bartlestone.
Hello again, everyone. This is Susan Bartlestone, and don't forget that Crime Prevention 101 is available on iTunes. You don't even have to be sitting at your computer in your cubicle to listen to all this wonderfulness. And don't forget that we also have a blog site, crimeprevention101.com, where I post links and information about the show topics and my wonderful guests. I'm going to put some information on my this trial that I was almost on up there. And so forth. Just a couple more jury stories that people told me about. Martine from our last segment told me one other story that I thought was really interesting. Her husband had to serve on jury duty, and it was a pretty clear-cut case, and it really wasn't going to take a long time to come to a decision. But there was one juror who decided that he didn't want to go home, that he wanted to stay overnight and be put up in the hotel that they were going to put the jury up in if they couldn't reach a decision. And he also wanted a nice meal, so he just simply refused to vote, kept them there all another day. Gotta love that. Then I got an email from a young person. He sent me a really cool video of his experience waiting in the jury room and waiting and waiting and waiting. His name is Justin Riray, I think, R-I-R-A-Y. And he is a student out at San Jose State University. And when he sent me the video, I asked him the question that I asked Dr. Kellerman last segment. You're 20-something. Could you make a decision that would sentence somebody to life? And he just said, basically, and I'm going to post his answer, but just to paraphrase it, he said, if the evidence was strong enough, I would have no problem deciding she was guilty, though I would feel terrible for her. And he said, I think that the purpose of justice is not just to punish people for breaking, it's not to punish people for breaking the law, but to ensure the safety of society by taking offenders away, putting them away. I mean, that's pretty mature. Good for you, Justin. And it was a funny video of him being bored in waiting for jury duty.
couple of other things that I wanted, little odds and ends I wanted to just mention. I did a show on the strangulation law, how it not being a crime in New York City, as well as quite a number of other states. And that show was June 3rd. And I just wanted to tell you that the Strangulation Prevention Act was passed on the 8th in New York State. So we now have penalties in strangulation cases, which I think is a great thing. I also did a bullying show on the 20th, and I found an article, May 20th, rather, that was. It was an interesting approach to stopping bullying. And I found a couple of tips that I thought were really good about diffusing a bully. And one of them, for example, was go along with the insult. And this is something that my guest on that show had mentioned. It's tough to do, but agreeing with a bully's taunts can deflate an attack. I'm going to put these tips up. These tips actually came from spryliving.com in their May issue. Ask for help, practice how to speak to the bully. It was very good. And I also got a question from a listener about the street harassment when I did the street harassment show on June 10th. And this listener asked all of my guests, I had three guests, people from Hollaback, D.C., and author Holly Curl. And the listener wanted to know, how do your guests view religion, education, and media, particularly pornography, regarding street harassment? Her name was Yvette Williams. And Holly Curl did a great response to this about how it doesn't matter what, if religion teaches you to disrespect women, there's something wrong here. And she did a really thoughtful response to this, and I'm waiting for the other two, so I'm going to post this on my crimeprevention101.com blog as well. I think that's really important. I forgot to tell you, there was another jury duty story. There was a juror, his name is Tom Lesser. He sent in this to me that he was picked as an alternate on this jury. And he said he realized that if he had been able to vote, an innocent man would not have been sent to prison. And he actually started a blog. He contacted the defendant's family, and he's trying to help overturn that jury. And I'm going to post some links to what he had to say too. I think he had a very interesting story to tell. Well, you know what? That's a wrap for now. Please don't forget that we always love to hear from you. By all means, go to my host page at voiceamerica.com, post your comments and suggestions, tell your friends about us, take a peek at crimeprevention101.com for more information about this. But never fear, because you and I will be doing this again next week, when we'll have more stories that demand to be told, more hot crime topics, and lots of tips and resources for you. It'd be a crime not to listen, so stay tuned and stay safe.
We hope you got some useful information and inspiration this week on Crime Prevention 101. Susan Bartlestone invites you to join us again next Thursday at 5 p.m. Pacific at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Voice America. If you want to learn more about Susan's guests, sign up for her newsletter, or find out about upcoming teleseminars and workshops, go to www.crimeprevention101.com today. Have a great week and a safe week.